Les conférences du Collège de France.
Mesdames et messieurs, dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to warmly welcome you to the first of four courses that Professor Neil Shubin will give during his stay as a guest professor in our institutions. My name is Denis Duboul. I hold the chair Evolution du Développement et des Génomes here at the Collège de France, and I'm absolutely delighted to be able to say a few words of introduction. Neil studied in Columbia University, then got his PhD in Harvard. He then moved to a short postdoc in Berkeley and came back to UPenn, came back on the coast, first as an assistant professor, associate, and full professor for 10 years. And he eventually moved to the University of Chicago. That was in 2000, just 25 years ago, in fact, where as a chair of the Department of Organismal Biology and Anatomy, where he is now the Robert Bensley Distinguished Service Professor of Anatomy. Now, I'm not going to list all the important scientific discoveries and institutional duties that Neil has accomplished over the years, 40 years actually. As I first heard about his name through a paper he published on limb development with the late Per Halbesch in 1986, so it's close to 40 years. I'm not going to do that because we would largely go over lunch, and I anticipate that in these four lectures, Neil will have the time to show you the various facets of his past and recent work. And therefore, rather than telling you about this, let me just briefly mention to you what I think has made his career particularly rich and outstanding. It is indeed, I believe, the combination of disciplines such as paleontology, evolution, and developmental biology from very early on in his education, in fact. And that makes him looking at fossils as sort of illustrations of mechanistic variations rather than as mere vestiges of the past. This particular multidisciplinary position, which is far to be frequent in these fields, has also led him to introduce new concepts of a very general impact, such as, for example, the idea of deep homology. For all this work, Neil has received a variety of awards, accolades, and he was elected to the National Academy of Science in 2011, where he's actually currently the chair of the evolution section. Neil has received other awards in different contexts due to his talent of a writer, and I would only mention one book, which is entitled The Inner Fish, which I'm sure some of you may have read. It has been translated in French, and it was a great success. In 2006, Neil published two papers in Nature, reporting the discovery of a very interesting fossil indeed, which the name was Tiktaalik. And I hope it will show you where this fossil, it's on that slide, likely, where this fossil was discovered in a remote place, difficult to reach, not very comfortable, to say the least, and full of unexpected dangers, showing that on top of everything, he's also a very courageous world field worker. But to be honest, I think these dangers are completely negligible when compared to his future expedition to Washington, D.C., which is planned for January 1st, 2026, where he will become president of the National Academy of Science. And this is a great honor, of course, but also a very complicated task, likely much more complex than facing polar bears. Neil, I'm so grateful that you maintain your visit to Paris, despite this critical upcoming duty, and I hope that this Parisian parenthesis will help you preparing this new job. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Denis. Thank you, Denise, Professor de Boulle, for the invitation. Thank you for the faculty for inviting me. It's a terrific honor to be with you for these next four lectures. I've been looking forward to this in so many ways. And so again, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity and this privilege to be with you these next few weeks. What we're going to do in these next four lectures is take a look into the past, the deep past inside our body, and we're going to be looking at some of the great transformations in the history of life on our planet. But importantly, our goal here, which we'll develop to the fourth lecture, will be thinking about innovation. We'll be thinking about the origin of new things, novelties, and evolution. So our goal is to look into the past, but we're also going to be thinking about the new, how new things and novelties arise. So that is our ultimate goal. But today we're going to begin by looking at ourselves in a very deep way. I begin with the knowledge that's been gained over the last 150 years that in each organ, in every tissue, in every cell, in every gene of our bodies, we contain artifacts of the history of life. Inside of us are whole branches of the tree of life that extend, in some cases, hundreds of millions, if not billions of years, deeply inside of us. Now, that is very precious knowledge to have, but it's also very important knowledge because we can leverage an understanding of our past, of our connections to the rest of life on our planet, to better our own lives, and I want to talk about that. So what we're going to be doing in this first lecture is to talk about how we understand this past inside of us, and then what we can use it for. And in future lectures, we'll be developing certain themes that are emerging here. Now, I should say this lecture actually began, versions of this lecture began when I was at the University of Chicago in my original job of teaching the medical students human anatomy. I was in the medical school teaching future doctors, future physicians about the body. And we would learn, and I would teach them with the teaching fellows and other professors about the structures in our bodies. And we'd dissect human cadavers. And it was a wonderful, thrilling experience, deeply. And during that course, I was the course director, the students would almost invariably ask me, they'd say, Dr. Shubin, Professor Shubin, what kind of doctor are you? Are you a surgeon? Are you a cardiologist? I mean, are you a psychologist? What are you? I said, well, no, I'm a fish paleontologist. I was like, well, okay, I think I want my money back on this in this enterprise. But that disconnection was a very powerful thing for me. Because being an anatomist, being a paleontologist, and not just any paleontologist, a fish paleontologist, is a very powerful way to teach and learn about our own bodies. And that's a surprising disconnect. But the reason for that is we have layers and layers and layers of history inside of us. From our primate, the history we share with other primates, the history we share with other mammals, the history we share with things we call reptiles, and on and on and on. It's like peeling an onion. We see our layers and layers of history deep inside of us that extend billions of years. And that's a very powerful way to teach about our bodies. And we'll start with a little bit of that today. But my real goal today is to show you how we know, not just what we know, but how we get this evidence, how we understand the fish inside of us, if you will. So for the first section of the talk, we're going to be looking at how we discover fossils, like you heard about in the introduction. And then we're going to make some sense about that, hopefully, and talk about a little bit about what it tells us about ourselves. So my entry to this began in graduate school. And I was actually, it was this slide that got me started. And it was a cartoon of what we knew at the time about the transformation from fish, in this case, a lobe fin fish, these are fish with lungs, some of which are alive today, to an early tetrapod, a limbed animal, creatures that lived in the late Devonian, 365 million years ago. And you look at this slide and you see the transformation from a fish-like body plan to the body plan of a tetrapod, a limbed animal. And there looks like there's a lot of differences. This is a big change. This is a huge transformation, and we're going to be focusing pretty heavily on this in my next lecture. But right now, we're going to show you how we know. And that means, to really understand this, my colleagues and I were thinking as paleontologists. We were wearing our paleontology glasses, if you will. We were seeing the world as paleontologists. And so looking at this, our goal became, and this is in the mid-1980s, really to begin to think about how we bridge this gap. Can we find intermediate fossils that show us the sequence of stages in the origin of tetrapod characteristics? Now, what you're not seeing on this diagram is our other species that we had known about. This is just a simple textbook cartoon. But there was a hint that there were species sort of in the middle between fish and tetrapod that had certain traits. We had bits and pieces of them. So what you're seeing on top is a cartoon of a fish from rocks about 390 million years old. It's a lobe-fin fish. It's a cartoon, and you can see its fin there. And on the bottom, you have an early tetrapod, and that's a limbed animal. And that's, again, as I said, a fossil from rocks about 365 million years old. And you see there's differences in the changes of the shape of the head. There's a neck in tetrapods where the head is separate from the body, and whereas in the fish on top, their head is not separate from the body. And big time, you can see the difference in the appendages. The fish have fins, and tetrapods have limbs with fingers and toes and wrists and ankles and all that stuff, right? Big change. And there were hints that there were maybe flat-headed fish fossils known somewhere in the world. There were some pieces of them known. And so we decided to really target the fossil record, and this is what I want to impress on you, that you can begin to target the fossil record for fossils that bridge gaps in evolution, that tell us how new species arise. Okay, so the first part of this talk is really telling how we target this transition to find, say, maybe a flat-headed fish with fins, with arm bones inside, you know, the whole milieu of characteristics. So the way you do this is in principle, very, very simple. In execution, it's really hard. But let's start with the principle piece. In principle, what you do, if you want to, say, bridge this gap, you look for places in the world that have three things. If you want to lead an expedition to find an intermediate fossil, you look for places that have three things. The first thing you look for are places in the world that have rocks of the right age to answer your question, right? So you're not looking randomly. You look at the right time period. That seems obvious. It's actually pretty hard. But you try to do that. You try to find a window of time. So in this case, you have the critter on top is about 390 million years old. The fossil on the bottom is about 365. You want to be in the middle. And you can constrain this more by taking phylogenetic or evolutionary trees and putting them on a geological time scale, something like this, a very simple one. And what you see on the left is a geological time scale. These are the ages within the Devonian period. What you see on the right is an evolutionary tree, and these black lines are where these different species in age, these fossils come from. Okay, so you have a evolutionary relationships mapped on time. Now this helps me as a paleontologist, because what it tells me is if I want to look to say these are early tetrapods, if I want to find early limbed animals, I want to be in this window of the phylogenetic tree here, which when I read it off is in these rocks, what is in this time period known as the Fronian, the S is silent, of 382 or so million years old. So okay, time. Everybody gets that, right? So we have tools to make predictions about what the right time period in the geological history to find these fossils are. The next is, once you have those rocks of the right age and you've constrained that, is to look for places in the world that have rocks of the right type to hold these fossils. And this is part science, part art, because you're never really sure if you're wrong. The trick here is what we wanted is to find rocks that were formed in the environments that these creatures likely lived in. Okay, no surprise there. We don't want to look in rocks that were formed in the deep ocean, right? You probably didn't have early walking creatures living in the deep ocean. We didn't want creatures that were living on land, purely on land, like in deserts and things. You wanted something in an intermediate environment. So what we wanted were rocks that were formed in, this is the guess we made, in this kind of environment. We wanted rocks of the right age, that late Devonian age, that were formed in ancient delta systems, much like the Amazon Delta today. Why do we think that? Why is because if you look at this delta system, What you have is a sea to one side with tidal flats and near shore areas. And then you can go upstream into estuaries. You can go in the sea to the tidal flats, to the estuaries, into rivers and streams, into even lakes. That is, this delta system, if you have it captured in the rock record, has all the right environments that these creatures likely would have lived in the Devonian period. Rocks of the right age, and then the rocks of the right type were rocks that were formed in ancient delta systems. Now, the thing that's nice about this, and this was a big bet on our part, the thing that's nice about this is that this kind of rock sequence in the geological record has a very unique signature. Geologically, in terms of the sediments and the layers, you can tell where you have rocks that were formed in ancient delta systems. So that is really the first two parameters. Rocks of the right age, you saw that. Rocks of the right type, this is the guess we made. We knew we wanted to be in middle to late Devonian age rocks, about 380 million years old, formed in ancient delta systems. And the other thing, the third criterion, is actually very obvious, but the hardest, is that you want those rocks exposed at the surface. Very obvious. And you don't want them buried, you know, 12 kilometers underground. They need to be accessible, right? So that's what you do. You have those filters. You look at the world, and you try to identify places that have ancient delta systems and with late Devonian rocks, with rocks that are exposed to the surface. So to test this out, we decided to work very locally. I was at the time, as Professor Dubul mentioned, I was actually at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia in the southeastern corner of the state of Pennsylvania. And it turns out I got very lucky because about a 3-hour drive from my home were rocks shown in purple here, which was mapped by the Pennsylvania Geological Survey, of Devonian age. Remember I told you rocks are the right age? We're kind of in the window here. Not exactly where we wanted to be, but it was young, but mostly. Furthermore, when you look at what made those rocks in Pennsylvania, they were actually originally, it's a delta system. 380 million years ago, or 365 million years ago, Pennsylvania, like much of the eastern part of the United States, was an ancient delta system, much like the Amazon Delta today. So right near my home in Philadelphia, I had rocks more or less of the right age, rocks that were formed in the right environments. Now, do our rocks, are the rocks exposed? Is that third criterion? The answer is no. So my research program for the early part of my career when I wasn't doing developmental biology was to find where those rocks are exposed at the surface. And it turned out that the best exposures, and I'm not kidding you, are where the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation was building new roads. Because when Pennsylvania Transportation was building new roads, they'd open up road cuts with dynamite and bulldozers. And if I was really lucky, they'd do it at a place where you had Devonian rocks. And we got super lucky. We had this road cut in central Pennsylvania, about an hour north of Penn State University, sister college to where I was. And what you see here is the road, and you could see a human being. There's our cars there. There's a human being for scale. And you can see these different layers, right? Pop, 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 one on top of the other. If I was to show you them close on, you'd see you're looking at the cross-section of ancient rivers and streams of Devonian age. And almost, so we'd follow PennDOT around. They'd dynamite, and they'd, you know, make a new road, and we'd be there like the next weekend looking at rocks. And then they kick us off because we're worried about insurance. But we, you know, but ultimately, we ended up finding stuff. So we first started finding like teeth the size of railroad spikes, size of your thumb. Then we'd find the jaws of these creatures. This is my colleague Ted Deschler, who's been my partner and my co-PI in all this. He's holding the front end of one of these jaws. These are jaws that would be about, the jaw itself with the teeth would be about the length of your arm. These are fish that were about 15 feet long in Devonian age rocks. We started to find body skeletons of fish. Not perfect, but they were there. These are fish. This is actually a relative of early tetrapods. And we started to find those in these rocks by the side of a road in Pennsylvania. And then things changed big time for us. When cracking rocks, we found arm bones, upper arm bone, a humerus, leg bones, parts of the shoulder, parts of the skull of early creatures living on land. All by the side of a road in Pennsylvania. So this was proof of concept that these environments, if we had the right age rocks, can really answer our question. Remember I told you I wanted a flat-headed fish with fins, with arm bones inside? Well, we worked with the National Geographic Society in the United States to do a reconstruction of what the side of that road looked like in Pennsylvania 365 million years ago. And this is kind of what it is. Here's that big fish, you know, with teeth the size of your thumb, 15 feet long. You don't want to swim with that. That would not work out well for us. You had armored fish, and we had all kinds of different fish with fingers, creatures with fingers and toes and wrists and ankles. We had tetrapods. It was great. This was proof of concept. But there was one problem. These rocks were too young. These rocks were 365 million years old. We needed, remember that diagram I showed you earlier with the phylogenetic evolutionary tree and the time? We needed to be at about 380 million years old, right? That's where the branch points were. But we were too young here. So we had proof of concept, but we're in the wrong place. So we had to start again. So we went on a search for where in the world would we have these deltaic rocks formed in deltas, the right age. And we found maps like this. And this is the kind of map that led us ultimately to success. And in fact, this diagram is the diagram that ultimately led us to where we were ultimately successful. It says Upper Devonian Sedimentary Facies, which is the right age, you're in Upper Devonian Age. Sedimentary facies, these are rocks formed in sedimentary regimes, like rivers, streams, oceans, that sort of stuff. And here you see North America. I could show you ones for other parts of the world, but here's North America. And these authors had overlaid on this map the environments that those Devonian age rocks formed in. So you could see this sort of brick sort of thing. This was an ancient Devonian ocean out here in the western part of North America. But these authors identified three areas using the geological literature that were mapped over years that were Devonian age rocks formed in ancient delta systems, kind of what we're looking for. Well, this first one, we knew about that, Catskill Late Devonian. That's where those fossils I just showed you about were from. Okay, we got that. The next one is East Greenland. That was Late Devonian. You know that tetrapod cartoon I've been showing you with the flat-headed creature? That's a cartoon of creatures that were found in the 1930s and again late in the 80s by Swedish and British teams over a number of years of early tetrapods. So again, we knew about that. And I think you can see where I'm going. Extending 1,500 kilometers east to west across the Canadian Arctic were mapped Devonian age rocks, actually older, late to middle Devonian, meaning there's older, across the Canadian Arctic, and they were virtually unexplored for fossils. They were worked on by geologists, that's how we got this information, but nobody looked for fossils. You actually have to be looking for them. This was what we were looking for, because we now had a place, rocks of the right age, rocks of the right type. If we just had exposures, rocks exposed at the surface, we'd be good. And it got even better when we looked at the geological maps. So here is a stratigraphic or geological column showing the different ages here, and these are the different groups of rocks. They're called formations. You have a map here on the upper left. This is circled in red here is Nunavut territory of Canada, the northernmost territory, Inuit environment in Canada, territory in Canada. Now we zoom in on these upper northern islands here, and that's the main body of our slide. And you can see here's Ellesmere Island, it's a big island, Melville Island, there's all kinds of islands up there. This is about a latitude of 78 to 80 north, that kind of thing. And circled in red here are where middle and upper Devonian rocks are exposed at the surface. So now we knew we had exposed rock at the surface across, there's 100 kilometers, across a vast territory of the Canadian Arctic. Rocks the right age, rocks the right type, rocks exposed at the surface. Now all I had to do was get there and not die. It was perfect. Okay, so this is kind of what leads us there. I'm showing you how the hunt is done, right? Well, this is just the beginning of the hunt, because it took us 6 years to ultimately be successful. We were failures for five of them, paleontologically speaking. So I'm no longer down here, right, driving, you know, to the paying, you know, gas money and so forth. We're now up here. And it's a whole different kettle of fish, so to speak, to use the idiom, working up there to try to find fossils. Now you're, you know, it's daylight 24 hours a day in summer. It's, you know, cold. There are polar bears up there. Polar bears hunt humans. There we had to be mindful of. There are no roads. We had to get in and out. To give you a sense of how remote this is, and this affects our science. This is why I'm doing this, is it's so remote. This is the nearest town I'm going to show you. It's a town, the northernmost permanent human community in the world. It's called Grise Fjord, Canada. Has 150 Inuit and some others. It's about 250, 300 miles from our fossil sites. And this is a picture of that town in spring. So we're very, very far, very remote. So to think about how to do science in this remote location. So it's one thing to have the hypothesis. Okay, we had that now. And we had tested it in Pennsylvania. Now we really needed to do it here in Canada. And the way to do this was really to think about logistics. That is, we're beyond the tank of gas for a helicopter to get to us. So we have to use these bush planes called Twin Otters, which are just amazing. They land directly on the tundra, unprepared airstrips. They have big balloon tires. And they can land in unprepared strips. They come in with fuel, and then the helicopter will get the go to the remote site, get the fuel, and get us into camp. So it's a real logistics, planning, fuel, food, weights. I mean, so these helicopters have to fly long distances. They can't take a lot of weight. That affects our science. Why? Because fossils are heavy. They're like rocks. So if you find anything, you have to make the decision what goes, what stays. This is all going into what I'm talking about. This is the nitty-gritty of doing this business, right? Because it affects the scientific tests and hypotheses we can make. To give you a sense, I mean, we don't take big crews. We take a small crew. This is like before a helicopter picks us up. This is what it looks like. Small number of people. We usually take a youth from that Inuit village. It's a remarkable experience. Our food all has to come in freeze-dried. It's vacuum sealed in these containers here because there are polar bears out there. But you get the sense. Planning is essential for this. You want to not only find fossils, but our crew has to work safely there and come home safely. Right? That's the biggest thing. Right? Okay, so we figured this out. Okay, it's a big problem, big puzzle. It was fun to figure out. 1999, we go there, and we start in the western part of the Arctic where this arrow is. And this is what camp looked like in 1999. So we had the idea to work here in 1998. And then we got the, took us a while to get money and permits and all this good stuff. So we're out there, and this is kind of what we do. This is to give you a sense of how the sausage is made, so to speak. These are each our own personal tents. We live in those. This is the kitchen slash science tent. We get water right from the melting streams. It's the best water around. This is water from snow that fell when Neanderthals were walking the earth. So it's pretty remarkable place to work that way. And it's very remote. And then these were the exposures we worked on this first year. So what you do is you walk around, we have a geological map, and we look for the bones that are weathering out on the surface. We're not digging immediately. We're scanning the surface to see where bones are weathering out. Now, to do that correctly, you have to know or begin to figure out how erosion happens. How water or snow or wind will degrade the rock in such a way that you could find fossils. So a lot of the working in these places is not just the logistics, but knowing how the rock behaves in these conditions. We found fossils here, but these were all fossils of sharks and other deep water organisms. We realized in the middle of this 1999 expedition, we were in the middle of an ancient ocean, and there was no chance we were going to find likely the critters we were looking for while we were finding bones. Furthermore, the exposures weren't great. It's very flat. You need something. We tend to like things that are a little more montane. All right, we made a mistake that first year, but we learned a lot about how to work there, how erosion happens. Error sometimes can be very fruitful because while we made a mistake and popped down in the wrong part of the Arctic, we learned how to work there. We learned how the rocks erode. All that nuance that ultimately led to success happened because of this kind of failure. What happened was, I'm going to show you a diagram that I showed you before. This applied to Pennsylvania, but it applies equally well to the Arctic. We were in the middle of an ancient ocean. We needed to go in the streams. We needed to go in the tidal flats. We needed to go where there's more land, right? Where there's that transitional zones. That meant geologically, we were too far west. We needed to go east. We started out here. That was a bust. So we had to go the next year, this is in 2000, to here, Southern Ellesmere Island. And that is where you had rocks that were formed in ancient rivers and streams. We were no longer in the middle of an ancient Devonian ocean. This is camp that year in 2000, and you can see these mountains here. You can actually climb these. These aren't, you know, you won't you'll be out of breath, but you won't get killed. It's not like technical or anything like that. And in fact, this kind of exposure is perfect for finding fossils because it's fresh, it's clean, it's sharp. You know, so this turned out to be better. And as soon as we hit this, we started to find bones of fossil lobe fin fish. These are the fish that today have lungs and in the past had similarities in their skeletons to early tetrapods. But this was good, but we were only finding bits and pieces. We weren't finding whole skeletons. The quest continues. We had to find a new part that had these kinds of rocks and these kinds of exposures that were formed in gentle conditions. These were in the rocks here, these were fast-moving rivers. We needed rivers that were very slow-moving. We needed lakes and ponds. We needed something that would preserve whole skeletons better. We found that. That was in a valley further to the east, and it was this spot right here. It was a valley we worked on. And in this spot, I'm showing you here, this is further to the east. This is in another, I'm collapsing 6 years for you. This is in, you know, like year three or four. This arrow is pointing to this gray patch right here. See that gray patch? That gray patch is a carpet of fish bones. Tens of thousands of fish bones. To the point where the day we found it, we were pulled up about thousands of these. This is us at 2 in the morning. Remember I told you it's daylight, 24 hours a day? Crawling this spot, picking up all these pieces of bone. And we're seeing these are pieces of lungfish. These are pieces of early relatives of ours. Furthermore, they were on the surface, and if we could find the layer that they came from, we had the chance of getting whole skeletons. And that's exactly what happened. We chased it. It took us another year to chase that to a layer, and this is the layer. This is my colleague Ted, who's been my co-PI on all this. Hello, Ted. And there's the layer. And this layer, where all those fragments on the surface were from, were produced by one skeleton of fish piled on top of the other. It was a whole layer of skeletons. It took us a while to get there, but we still didn't have what we were looking for. We still didn't have it. Why? Because we were finding skeletons, but we were finding species we already kind of knew before from other parts in the world. Well, so we worked this layer. We worked it much like this, you know, one person next to the other, about six people, getting very friendly. Everything changed when we had this spot right here, which is after we made a big discovery, but that's the space right there. So here you can see the rocks. These are Devonian rocks. See how they're tilted? That tilting helped us a little bit in how the rocks weathered. You could see people down here, and we're doing stuff with fossils, but this is the layer. Working that layer, one day, my colleague Steve Gatesy from Brown University, this is Steve right here, this is my mentor, Farris Jenkins, by the way, who I owe everything to, who taught me this approach to the fossil record. That's Farris right there, the late Farris Jenkins. This white arrow points to what was the big discovery that day. And that is, you can see this little V here. I know you think I'm crazy, but I'm not. You can see this little V here, and it's the same color as the rock, right? But it has a different shape. Not only does it have a different shape, but if I was to zoom in, and you're going to see it pretty soon, there are teeth in there. This is an upside-down head. I remember when Steve pulled the rock out of here and said, hey, Neil, what's this? I came over, and as soon as I saw that, I knew we had found what we had spent 6 years looking for. Why? Because I was looking at the front end of a snout of a fish, and I knew it was a fish because the texture of these bones was fish-like, and the teeth were very fish-like. But it was an upside-down snout of a flat-headed fish. Remember the early slide where I show you conical head to flat head? Here I had a flat-headed fish looking right at me after 6 years. That was a good day. But there was some panic that happened after that because now we had to remove this fish, and the weather was not very good, and we only had a couple weeks. So we pedestaled it out. And see, part of the working here means getting the right eyes. People who do embryology get eyes and hands. They know how to work with embryos. People who do fossils get the right hands to work with fossils, and they get the right eyes to see the difference between fossil and bone. And that's what a lot of this was. I was only able to see this because I had worked there for 6 years. But anyway, this comes in the base of a helicopter. There's a first-year graduate student for scale. They love doing that, and I don't know why. I'm too old for that job. But there's the fossils in the middle. They come back in a helicopter. Interestingly, the bone is harder than the rock. The fossil bone is harder than the rock in this place. So when you put it under a microscope with a pin vise, and you can remove the rock grain by grain, that fossil, remember that V I showed you about with the white arrow? That's this. Flat head, eyes on top. Right? That's what we were looking for. That's what that fossil was. And then months later, it took about 6 months to get there, here's a flat head, one eye, there's another eye. Look, it even looks like it has a head that's separate. This is one shoulder from another shoulder. The head that's separate from the shoulder girdle. Looks like we're getting to tetrapod. Remember, there's the fish on top, the tetrapod on the bottom, conical head to flat head, no neck to sort of a version of the neck, fins and limbs. What we had here was a flat-headed fish with fins with limb bones inside. This is this creature, Tiktaalik rosea. I showed you the head. This is that creature I showed you that had that V-shaped thing. We've subsequently found like 20 of these. We have little ones, we have big ones. It's a real real bonanza of Tiktaaliks up there. This has scales in its back and fins with fin rays, with fin webbing, right? So it's fish, right? But like an early tetrapod, I don't know. It has flat heads with eyes on top, has a neck where the head is separate from the shoulder, mostly separate. There's still a small connection there. And when you crack open the fin, you have bones that correspond to upper arm, forearm, even parts of a wrist. And, oops, go back. So here's the one of the fins, and we have a number of specimens. There's the humerus, upper arm bone, radius, ulna, terminal bones. It has a shoulder. Here you can see the ball on the humerus. That's upper arm bone. Socket on the shoulder. Here's the elbow of this fish. There's two wrist joints, what's known as a proximal carpal and distal carpal joints. They compare to amphibians. So I was like, that was good. And then subsequently, we've been able to use a CT scanner, high-energy CT scanner, to scan every single bone of the main specimen, which is this one, done other ones. We've scanned everything now. We have a digital library. And by the way, you can access that online. It's all available. But this is the latest reconstruction. Actually, not the latest. But you can see we've scanned it, and you can see it has a whopping big pelvis. I'm going to talk about walking next Wednesday. Big ribs are differentiated. Big hind fin, large forefin. You get the sense. It's a real mix of fish and tetrapod characteristics. We still don't have the tail. But I'm not going to go back just to find the tail. There's a lot of other things I got to do. And I have to dodge polar bears in D.C. So this is a beautiful reconstruction done in Sebastian Steyer's book, Life Before the Dinosaurs. It captures a lot of what Tiktaalik was about. It is a fish that lived in water, but also capable of living on the mudflats and on land. It had fins. It had a neck. It was a combination of fish and tetrapod characteristic, found at just the right time period in the fossil record. And I'm going to talk a lot about this transition of fish to tetrapod on Wednesday. I'm going to talk in detail about that and how we know transitions. But today I'm going to take it in a different tack. But it's a piece of a much larger puzzle to understand this event. It's one of many fossils that tell us about that, and we're going to talk about that on Wednesday. But really importantly here, this is a creature that has a version of a neck where it can swivel its head independently of its body. It has a wrist where the terminal end of the fin can bend relative to the other end of the fin. It could do a push-up. But what's interesting here is this is not just some esoteric event, dead end, in the history of life. This is something that's part of our own history, and that's today's talk. That once you find a fossil and do the hard work of finding a fossil like this, it tells you a lot about ourselves. Because Tiktaalik and its evolutionary cousins tell us about how wrists arose. Tiktaalik and its evolutionary cousins tell us about how our neck and other features arose when we put it in the context of the diversity of things that have been discovered in the history of life. And how do we know this? We know this in another way. We know this because we can trace the upper arm bone of fish and fish like Tiktaalik to amphibians, to reptiles, to other mammals, to people. We can trace the elbow. We can trace the fossils phylogenetically and evolutionarily from fish to tetrapod to us in many cases. There is lines of evidence. There are multiple lines of evidence that do this. This is one line of evidence. I've been spending 20 minutes talking to you about the fossil evidence and how we find it and what it can tell us. But then we can layer in, as you'll hear, the developmental biology. We can layer in the genetics. We begin to piece together these great events in the history of life and see how they are inside of us in many important ways when we pull all this evidence together. That's what I wanted to tell you. And so, you look at a human. This is Albert Einstein, a pinnacle of human achievement. When you are a fish paleontologist like myself, you see Einstein, but you kind of see him also as a version of a bipedal fish. And it's useful to compare Einstein to the fish. In case you're confused, I labeled it. Einstein's on your left, by the way. Let's look, I showed you the fossil approach, but let's look at development, because this is kind of where we're going to be going in later lectures. But if you look at a human head a few weeks after conception, what do you see? This is just Einstein's head, yours or mine, kind of, you know, any human. You know, paired primordia for the eyes here, and you have a series of structures, swellings filled with cells with some clefts between them. There's a lot of complex anatomy there. And there are four of them here. I've color-coded them, light blue, dark blue, green, and yellow, and you can see each one of them is a cleft. When you look at fish or sharks or pretty much any vertebrate, the head's not identical, but you find some roadmaps. You find some commonalities. You see paired primordia for the eyes. This is a shark embryo. And you see these swellings with the cells inside and the clefts and so forth. And there's regularities in what those cells do. Well, you can label these cells, and you can trace the cells in there to see what happens as they go from embryo to adult. And you can see in the shark embryo, the cells inside these structures, the pharyngeal arches, become upper and lower jaw and become the gill apparatus that lies caudal or behind it. And these are forming the muscles, the nerves, the bones. It's a general roadmap, this organization, to the head of a shark. Well, guess what? What happens in people? You see where I'm going. Well, the first arch becomes a portion of the lower jaw and two bones in the middle ear. The others become portions of throat bones or the voice box in the head. So there's a developmental tie here. What does this mean? This means that many of the bones I'm using to talk to you right now, from my voice box to my jaw, and the nerves and muscles that are controlling all that, correspond to gill structures in fish. That's what the developmental piece is telling us. But where this gains its elegance is the developmental piece can make predictions about what we find in the fossil record. Why? Because if you look at the fossil record, this bone right here, known as the hyomandibula, becomes the stapes. This second arch bone, see the second arch, first arch, second arch? The second arch bone becomes a second arch bone in our own ear. And you can trace it from sharks and fish to early amphibians, creatures like Tiktaalikan before, to the stapes itself. Paleontology, developmental biology, giving us this elegant roadmap of the history inside our bodies. And what's beautiful about this is when you think about development, and you think about the majesty and the beauty, and there's hard not to feel awe when you look at the fossil record, but importantly, when you look at what a single cell can become, you know, going from a single cell to trillions of cell organism, and we call that bodybuilding, but we call that bodybuilding because you're building a body with, you know, differentiated cells that are packed in the right places with the right organization at the level of organs, tissues, cells, and so forth. And that's driven by DNA and its complex interactions with within the egg and beyond. And really understanding this process is so vital with the paleontology to really understand the fish inside of us, the primate inside of us, the worm inside of us, to understand and unlock that history that lies deep, because the fish are only one stopping point. And because I'm just going to just look at this, if you look at, say, here's a living fish, this is a zebra fish, we'll talk about this in a later lecture, and here's a human, and you look at their fins, compare the fin to the limb, if you're comparing extant or living creatures, it looks pretty different, these are different things. In the fossil record, you can bridge those gaps, certainly, if you look at the right fossils. But I want to show you how, you know, when we look at development, just give a hint to that, we start to see the fish within us as well. Every bit as elegant as seeing fossils and beautiful speaking fossils. If you look at our hand, you know, here's a normal hand. We're all familiar with a five-digited hand. But there are a number of anomalies that appear in humans of where there are modifications of the digits. These are rare, but they happen. You have polydactyly, meaning many digits. Some are on one side, the preaxial side. You have others on the postaxial side. You have changes in the identity of digits and fingers. And I'm showing you this array of digital anomalies because these are genetic mutations of a particular gene known as sonic hedgehog. Right? And this happens in humans. Anomalies cause digital anomalies, as well as other things in the body, everywhere where sonic is expressed. And sonic hedgehog, this gene, is turned on in development. This is a chick embryo. Is turned on in development in one portion of the limb bud. This is the limb bud of a chicken. And this black here is where this gene is active, is expressed, the sonic hedgehog gene. And this is a normal chicken wing, right? Three digits, right? Everything's normal. Now, if you induce another, turn on Sonic Hedgehog through various means, either transplant it or chemical means, Sonic Hedgehog to the other side of the appendage, like do it here, so have it, now it's active not just on one side but on the other, you get a mirror image duplication of the appendage. And we've known this for a while, right? And it's extra digits, but a mirror image duplication. Furthermore, if you truncate or turn down Sonic Hedgehog signaling, you lose digits. So it really is part of a pathway. There are many genes involved here. Sonic is a big one, but Sonic is talking to many genes. And one of the outcomes of this is the digital pattern. But that's one common one when you sort of do the ectopic sign. You get Sonic on the other side, you get these doubles. How can we trace this? What's the deep history of this? This is something that affects our own digits. What's the history, genetic history inside of us? Well, here's a chick limb. My lab has looked at this. We looked years ago, like 25 years ago, looking at Sonic Hedgehog in fish, in sharks. And when you look at fish and sharks, the creatures which we share an ancestor 400 million years ago, guess what? Sonic Hedgehog is there. This is a skate, a close relative of sharks. And Sonic Hedgehog is in a similar position. This is a big fin bud of a skate. Looks very different, but it has Sonic in the right place. Furthermore, here's a regular one, a normal expression of Sonic. If you ectopically allow it to be turned on the other side, here's the normal, here's the other side, what you can get is, here's the untreated fin, you can get a mirror image duplication. So skates have, and sharks, I should say as well, have the pattern of Sonic Hedgehog expression that's similar to us. When we manipulate it, what do you see? You see things that are equivalent. Remember how chickens and mice, when you expose it, when you misexpress it, you have a mirror image duplication. And it gets even better, it gets even deeper. If you look at the regulatory regions, this is something that was discovered about 20 so years ago, here's the Sonic Hedgehog coding region of the gene. And about a megabase away, very far away, this is one of the first really good examples of an element that lies extremely far away, long range in the genome. This thing called the ZRS is a regulatory region, a region that controls, along with other things, the activity, the expression of Sonic Hedgehog, such that when the ZRS is modified, Sonic expression is modified in the appendage. And when you modify Sonic Hedgehog expression, you modify the digits. So this is something that's deeply involved in our normal digit development, right? And so it's been discovered that the ZRS drives limb-specific activity or expression of the gene, which I showed you is on that one side. Furthermore, mutations in this affect digit number. They can cause extra ones, cause less. Here's what's beautiful, and this is what fits into what I'm telling you. If we look at the ZRS, is it present in humans? Yes. Is it present in mice? Yes. This is a mouse is a baseline. This is a plot to show you similarity of the sequence of the ZRS, say of a mouse to a human, a mouse to a chick, a mouse to a lizard, a mouse to a coelacanth. The broader and wider this, the more similarity you have in the sequence of a mouse to a human. But if you look it all the way down, a mouse is similar to a skate, is similar in some ways to an elephant shark, a little bit zebrafish, a little bit truncated, but so there's weird things there. But it's very similar. What does this mean? What does this diagram mean? It means that the sequence of this very important regulatory element that drives the activity of Sonic Hedgehog in our appendages, which controls digit identity and number, is deeply conserved over 400 million years of evolution, to the point where, this is something I did with colleagues from Seville, where you can, here's a mouse limb bud, here's a zebrafish fin bud. If you take, say, the GAR sequence of that ZRS and put it in a mouse, you get what looks like normal expression of Sonic Hedgehog. If you take the coelacanth sequence and put it in a mouse, you get what looks like quasi-normal expression of Sonic Hedgehog. Likewise with a lizard. So you can take that element and you can see how deeply conserved that expression is. Skate has some, but it looks a little different. But then again, skates have very weird fins. And you can do the same thing with zebrafish. You can put the GAR in a zebrafish, the coelacanth in a zebrafish, and all in a zebrafish with a reporter line to show where things are expressed. It shows, what's this showing? Deep evolutionary conservation of the genes, or at least one of the major genes, and its regulatory elements that builds fins. We're going to talk about this more in detail later. I'm just introducing the concept now. What we're seeing is the deep history in our body that's 400 million years old. We're seeing that in fossils. We're seeing that in genes. We're seeing that in all evidence. And that's, I think, the elegance of comparative biology, particularly comparative experimental biology, comparative field biology, comparative biology that pulls together insights from multiple disciplines to tell us about a fundamental problem, which is the deep history of our body. So what I hope you are now able to see, hopefully you're more confused by this diagram because you see Einstein more as a fish than you did 50 minutes ago. But I hope you get some impression that we have deep history inside us. We see it genetically. We can uncover it developmentally. What it means is that fish can be a very profound system as models for certain types of human disease. And this is the zebrafish as well as other fish. Now almost any fish or any creature really can become a model system for understanding the human condition, whether it's blood cancers, whether it's melanomas, whether it's immune systems, diversity, you name it. A fish system is very powerful. One of many tools we now have to understand a betterment the human condition by leveraging other animals. And I guess that's where I want to end, because I find it, when you think about the breakthroughs that are going to extend and enrich our lives, you know, finding discoveries that will help us cure or better patients with Alzheimer's and different cancers and diverse diseases. I like to think that as we discover those cures and those therapies, that work that betters our lives, that extends our lives, will in some way be based on flies, worms, fish, mice, and goodness knows what other creatures that are out there. I can't imagine a more powerful or more beautiful statement about the importance of our evolutionary connection to the rest of life on our planet than that. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.